Okay, so that's my third distinctive feature. The fourth one is, and this is kind of similar, but it's not quite the same. In Mahayana Buddhism, we have distinctive soteriologies. Sorry to introduce a big word there, but it's quite hard to come up with a better one. Probably somebody will now. A soteriology is a theory of salvation or a theory of liberation, or a path of salvation and a path of liberation. So in early Buddhism, the way that you become liberated is that you go for refuge to the Buddha. I'm sure you know about this. You leave the household life, that's generally what was done, and then you practice meditation, you listen to the Buddhist teachings and so on, and through your intensive practice ultimately you realize nirvana. Yeah, that's the path. So you practice, you could say, ethics, meditation and wisdom. That's one of the ways that we would talk about the path. But actually it's quite different from that, or it can be quite different from that in Mahayana Buddhism, because one can become awakened in many different ways. In fact, one could become awakened through simply calling the name of a Buddha. I mean, how would that work? You call out the name of a Buddha, and through doing that, you become liberated. Just going to leave that idea for you at the moment. I'm not going to explain that. Or another idea might be that you could become awakened just in a moment, in an instant, even just right now. Somebody could say something, maybe even I could say something, and suddenly the lights would go on, and you'd be liberated. Or it could be that actually your path, as I said earlier, takes infinite lifetimes. It just goes on and on and on, and you become more and more spiritualized. You accomplish more and more spiritual qualities. You become more and more fantastic. So there's a number of different ways that the path to the goal has been conceived in Mahayana Buddhism, not just one way. And one important shift that took place, at least in some Mahayana Buddhist traditions, was a move away from the idea that actually it's me or it's you that fulfills the goal, towards the idea that actually we're not capable of doing that because we're more or less hopeless. We're certainly very limited. I'll just speak for myself. More or less hopeless, because the fact is, everything that we do, because we're ignorant, makes us even more ignorant. I mean, how could an ignorant person know what the right thing to do was? All of our decisions are guided by our ignorance. So that could lead us into a position where we think, well, why bother? Maybe it will lead us into that position. But seemingly, according to some Mahayana traditions, there are beings out there who are reaching out to us. They are actually reaching out to us. They're helping us along. So rather than us having to make the effort, they're making the effort to reach out to us, to welcome us, if you like, into the state of awakening. So that's a very different conception of what it might mean to practice Buddhism. A shift away from it's about me, it's about my effort and my path and my practice, towards it's about opening up to some higher power, or other power, to use a more technical term, something that's beyond us, something that's greater than us, that can bless us, that even in some strange way can transform us, that can purify us. This way of thinking about the Buddhist goal is found particularly in some forms of East Asian Buddhism, particularly called Pure Land Buddhism. And we might take up further discussion about this as the weeks go along. Okay, so the fifth distinctive feature that I wanted to pick up on was that the Mahayana has distinctive philosophical ideas. This is really quite a broad categorization, because philosophically Mahayana Buddhism is very, very broad. But there are philosophical ideas that emerge and become important in Mahayana Buddhism that weren't important in other Buddhist traditions. Amongst the most significant are those that belong to what's called the Majjhimaka tradition. Majjhimaka means middling, and I'm actually, when I look at Mahayana philosophy in more detail, I think we're going to focus more specifically, in most detail, on Majjhimaka. So since I'm going to not talk about some others, I'll just mention another one for now. So another tradition would be, a philosophical tradition would be, what's called Yogacara. Yogacara means something like the way of meditation, something like that. So Yogacara philosophy, its distinctive contribution, or one of its distinctive contributions, was to emphasize the importance of the mind and how it's our mind that, you could say, governs or controls our reality. It's the way that we see things, the way that we interpret things, that governs how we experience life. So from a Yogacara point of view, our problem is not that we need to get into some heaven world or some other world that's beyond the one that we're in right now. The problem is that we don't see the world that we're in right now in the right kind of way. So in order to become awakened, that's what we need to change. We need to change the way that we see the world. We need to change our interpretive framework. We need to change, if you like, the lens through which we look at our lives, through which we look at reality. And this was a distinctive contribution or distinctive emphasis found in the Yogacara philosophical tradition. Yeah, another distinctive philosophical idea that I'll just briefly flag up is the idea of Buddha nature. So again, this is an idea that is not really found in Nikaya Buddhism, but the idea of Buddha nature is that within us all, is the potential to become a Buddha. We have the nature inherently to become a Buddha. And in some forms, it starts to mean something like, not only can we become a Buddha, but actually deep down, we really are a Buddha already. That's our true nature. If we understood what we are, how we are fully, we'd recognize that actually we're Buddhas. And some people find this idea quite kind of simplistic, and they think that this is a very kind of unhelpful idea, because if we all just thought we were Buddhas, well, maybe we wouldn't do anything. You know, we'd just sit around and just congratulate ourselves for already being Buddhas. But I find it quite paradoxical. I find it quite intriguing, the idea that in some sense, in some ultimate sense, I'm a Buddha, because, well, I don't experience myself as a Buddha, so what does it really mean? What does it mean that I'm a Buddha deep down? And that's a paradox, or that's a particular struggle that's going on in my mind, trying to work that through. So there are distinctive philosophical ideas. There are a number of others too, but I don't think I've really got time to develop them right now. As I mentioned, I think in week 3 or 4, I've forgotten now, I will be returning to discuss some of the distinctive ideas of Majjhamika philosophy in more detail. So we come to my sixth and final distinctive feature, and that is distinctive practices. So we have in Mahayana Buddhism practices that either didn't exist or perhaps weren't emphasized in earlier forms of Buddhism. So there is a great deal of continuity between Nikaya Buddhism and Mahayana Buddhism. We should recognize this, but there's also some distinctive additional contributions that emerge within Mahayana Buddhist practice. Perhaps one of the most distinctive practices would be the systematic devotion towards trans-historical Buddhas, towards cosmic Buddhas. The Buddha is a devotional figure in Nikaya Buddhism, but I don't think devotion is emphasized to quite the degree that it is in some Mahayana Buddhist traditions. So this becomes a distinctive emphasis, the emphasis on what we could call Buddha cults. And I don't mean that term in any negative way, I just mean simply a tradition that is focused on a Buddha as a devotional centre. But alongside there being Buddha cults, there are also cults around particular bodhisattvas, particular figures who were seen as having cosmic importance, who were seen as exemplifying the Mahayana Buddhist ideal, and who could be seen as helping other beings to accomplish that. They also became objects of devotion. And perhaps the most well-known of those is, in Sanskrit, is known as Avalokiteshvara. Although I noticed that somebody had posted a poster for a puja downstairs with the Chinese name, which is Kuan Yin, of this figure. So Avalokiteshvara, or Kuan Yin, is a figure that exemplifies cosmic awakening. And in fact, in one of his or her forms, which I've always been very, very struck by, this figure appears as a standing figure with 11 heads and 1,000 arms. 1,000 arms, and they sort of form this penumbra all round. 1,000 could be infinite, it's just 1,000, because I guess it's probably hard to paint much more than that. But in principle, there's an infinite number of arms and hands, and each of these hands reaches out to help beings along the path to awakening. So Avalokiteshvara Kuan Yin became the object of a very powerful devotional cult, and still is. Other distinctive practices are, probably everybody has heard of the word koan, although I rather suspect that far fewer have a solid grasp of what that term refers to. But the koan is a particular, well, it became a meditative type technique that originated in China, and it was originally based on the apparent records that describe meetings between masters and their disciples. And let me just think if I can remember one of my favourite ones for you. So there's one about a master called Nan Quan, and he comes across a group of his students. I think they're in argument. They're arguing. I think they may be arguing about a cat. And the master picks up the cat and he says, "If you can say it, I won't kill it." And nobody knows what to say. They don't know what it is they're supposed to say in order to stop him killing the cat. So nobody says anything. So he kills the cat. I've worried you now, haven't I? So this particular encounter clearly was very intriguing for a lot of people. And over time, various masters would comment on what it meant and what happened and why was he killing a cat and so on and so forth. But over time as well, or rather ultimately, this consolidated into a meditative practice, an introspective practice, where the student would reflect on, well, what does it mean? What does it mean that he killed the cat? And puzzling over this, struggling with this, is said to bring about a process of transformation. In fact, it's said to induce a condition of doubt, where the student is just completely confused. They don't know which way is up. And from this state of confusion, some insight arises, some direct insight into the nature of the truth. So this is koan practice. Just to reassure you, by the way, most of these stories cannot be credited as historical fact. So we're looking at a kind of more of a literary story rather than the master really killing the cat. Yeah, so there's just a couple of examples of some distinctive practices, really. I don't think I'll say more now.